conduct our discussions of energy in the future by talking about energy conservation. We've made references to the importance of conserving our energy resources, as well as seeking new sources of energy throughout the week. But today we focus on the two important considerations in energy conservation, and I don't think we can afford to overlook either one of them. The first is how to reduce consumption of energy intensive goods and services, and the second is how to improve the efficiency of energy utilization. Now, 5/6 of the energy used in transportation, 2/3 of the fuel used to generate electricity, and 1/3 of the remaining energy, about 50% of our total energy consumed, is discarded as waste heat. Yet very little research has been devoted to energy utilization. Buildings are still constructed with inadequate insulation, with excess ventilation, with large window areas, all of which increase the energy needed for both heating and cooling. Automobile engines are far more powerful than they need be. Many home appliances are terribly inefficient. Industrial plants waste a very high percentage of the energy used by employing inefficient and energy extravagant processes. Energy has been too cheap to make conservation economically rewarding. Hopefully this is going to change. As we've pointed out before, energy conversion, especially where it involves thermal processes, can never be 100% efficient. There always must be heat loss, but the trick in designing in efficient energy conversion now is to minimize this heat loss. Let's just briefly review what happens when we convert heat to mechanical energy or vice versa. Diagrammatically now on this slide we have a heat engine and a heat pump, the two basic heat conversion devices. The heat engine takes heat from some kind of a hot reservoir, converts a part of it to useful work, and exhausts the remainder as waste heat. The refrigerator does just the opposite. It takes heat from a colder reservoir, pumps it to a hotter reservoir by doing work. Now, the efficiency of a heat engine then is the amount of work that you get out divided by the amount of heat you put in. And the closer that efficiency is to one, the less waste heat will be exhausted. Examples, of course, of heat engines are steam turbines. The automobile is a type of heat engine. You burn the fuel and produce a certain amount of heat, so the cylinder itself becomes the hot reservoir. You do a certain amount of mechanical work, and the balance of the heat is exhausted to the cool reservoir, which in this case is the atmosphere. A refrigerator is a good example of a heat pump, where mechanical work is supplied mainly in the form of compressing the evaporated gases mechanically in order to pump heat from a cold reservoir, which is the inside of the refrigerator in this case, to a warmer reservoir, which is the room. Now, we'll come back to this, but let's go on and talk about where the heat, where the energy is utilized, where we ought to be focusing our attention. This slide we've looked at before. We focus on the right-hand side of it now, where you see that industrial uses of all kinds account for about 37% of our energy utilization, transportation for 25%, residential and commercial uses, mainly heating, cooling, and lighting, account for 22%. Let's look at the space heating question first of all. Somebody brought up a question here before we started about alternative methods of space heating. So let's discuss this for just a little bit. The usual way of heating buildings, commercial buildings or homes, is by uses of furnaces that burn fossil fuel and give off heat, either air, which is circulated around the building, or hot water or steam, which is circulated throughout the building. Now, furnaces are fairly efficient, well, at least the way they come from the factory. Furnace efficiencies typically run 75, 80, 85%. That is, that much of the fuel that's burned actually goes into space heat. The remainder is exhausted as up the stack as waste heat. Although infrequent maintenance sometimes reduces this figure considerably below the factory rated figure. Now, during a period, especially in the 1960s, there were a lot of buildings and homes built with electric resistance heating. That is, where the electricity was merely passed through some kind of a resistive element, and so kilowatt for kilowatt electricity was converted to heat. Now, of course, if properly designed, this conversion is 100% because there is no exhaust gas or anything, but generating and transmitting that electricity accounts the losses in generating and transmitting it account for 70% of the fuel burned by the power company, so that the overall efficiency of an electric resistance system like this is only 30%. Now, one way that you can heat with electricity in a fairly economical, well, economical fuel-wise way, is by using heat pumps. And as yet, I don't know of anyone that's put out a heat pump designed for home use, but a lot of commercial buildings use those. And of course, a heat pump is a refrigerator that's with the cold element outside and the warm element inside, so that if you're using mechanical energy to pump heat from the rather cold outside to the warmer inside. And depending upon the ambient temperatures inside and out, heat pumps can deliver 2 to 3 or even 4 units of heat for every unit of energy consumed. So you can multiply this 30% that you get from an electrical system by at least 2 or 3, and you begin to approach the efficiency or equal the efficiency of a fossil fuel furnace type system. Now, if you want, really, in my opinion, the ultimate in efficiency is a heat pump run not with an electric motor, but with some kind of a natural gas internal combustion engine. And a few of these have been put into operation, but they're expensive. The fuel cost, of course, is negligible, but they're expensive to buy and install in the first place. And with a heat pump, if you can reduce the ambient, the difference between the temperature of the cold reservoir out of which you're pumping the heat and the hot reservoir into which you're exhausting it, you get an increase in efficiency. And so there have been systems put in with storage reservoirs, where instead of taking the heat using, instead of having to use as your cold reservoir the ambient outside temperature, which might be 0 degrees, you use an underground source of water that, say, stays at a constant 40 degrees or 50 degrees. In fact, there was a system put in when some of you are from the Twin City area, when Southdale was originally built. They put in a two-reservoir system where during the summer the water that was used to cool the air conditioners then was pumped from the cold reservoir into the hot reservoir. And this created a large reservoir of warm water, which was used as a source of heat during the winter, so that the heat pumps could take the heat out of that and pump it back in the cold reservoir, which thermodynamically is a very efficient system. You get a lot of heating and cooling per unit of energy expended. The problem is the initial cost of providing these large underground reservoirs. And of course, you have to consider the energy that it took to create these underground reservoirs in the first place. One of the worst offenders in, especially in public buildings, is excess ventilation. People tend to want we tend to be fresh air fanatics. In a typical public building, the mix of recirculated makeup air may run 60-40 or something like that. And of course, every bit of fresh air that you introduce into the into a heating or a cooling system costs a tremendous amount in energy, because there you have to start from a very low temperature in the winter or a very high temperature in the summer and change the temperature of a large volume of air. And I my pet peeve is that you go into a large auditorium or a large meeting room, and there may be one or two or three or four people smoking in it, but in order to allow them that privilege, we have to bring in thousands of cubic feet of fresh air. And I've often said that it would be, I don't mind their smoking, but it would be much cheaper to provide them with a fume hood, you know, a big hood like this, and say, all smokers, please sit under this hood, so we don't have to bring in thousands of cubic feet of fresh air just so you can have a cigarette. But most public buildings could run with much, much, much less fresh air than they do. In fact, there are still people from the old school that don't believe that conditioned air, recirculated air, is quite as healthy as fresh air. And so, regardless of what the temperature is outside, they want to sleep with the windows open, or they want to air out the house once in a while, and so on. And that comes at a great cost energy-wise, believe me. Air conditioners have a wide range of efficiencies, from anywhere from 5 to 12 BTUs of cooling per watt hour of electricity. Now, one of the big electric companies has started a series of advertisements informing you of this and telling you to look at the rating of your air conditioner before you buy it, which is very good. But there are an awful lot of very inefficient air conditioners that have already been installed. And so there's a wide range. An air conditioner that produces 10,000 BTUs of cooling is not equivalent, is not all air conditioners with this rating are not the same. Some of them take very much more electrical power to operate. Nearly a fourth of all electricity is used for lighting. Now, fluorescent lights, of course, use about a fourth as much energy as incandescent lights, and some of the new high-pressure halogen lamps and mercury lamps are even more efficient than incandescent lights. The illumination levels in most industrial buildings have tripled in the last 15 years. This is not all bad, of course. If increased lighting brings about increased efficiency of work, or if it leads to conservation of sight, I'm all for it. But we have probably gone a bit far in the level of lighting, especially, in my opinion, the level of street lighting. There seems to be an unquestioned feeling that increasing the level of street lighting cuts down on street crime, and I don't think that's ever been proven, or at least I've never seen any conclusive statistics that show that to be true.
But you feel safer.
Pardon?
You feel safer.
You feel safer, that's it. Yeah, you feel safer if it's sprayed outside. You know, you fly over the countryside in an airplane now, and it's just absurd. You can't find, you know, there's lights everywhere. Even out in the country, every farm has a big kilowatt yard light that runs around the clock, runs all night. And I think that you put your you hit the nail on the head there. Everybody feels safer, whether they are or not. But there's no doubt about it in my mind that a great deal of lighting could be eliminated. You know, it bugs me up here. Of course, I realize that there's the energy conservation up here is pointless. But you know, the lights burn all the time. It's just kind of I have to keep reminding myself that really this electricity is all free, and there's absolutely no place it could be transmitted. You know, or anything, the excess electricity. So but this is one of the few places where energy conservation is during the summer is probably meaningless, because we've got more than we can use. Not so in the wintertime. Home appliances, of course, are great energy guzzlers. Frost-free refrigerators use from 1.5 to 2 times the energy of the conventional ones. Electric stoves, dryers, and water heaters are certainly very wasteful of energy. Pilot lights. Pilot lights on stoves, on gas stoves, use typically in the average household use half of the total gas that's consumed. Now, one of the problems, of course, is that electric rates have not reflected the cost of electrical energy at all. We encourage large consumers. We discourage conservation of energy by the our electric rate policies. Those of you who were here yesterday, we know we had a lengthy discussion on this. Walter Heller, the well-known economist at the University of Minnesota, has, among others, has proposed elimination of all depletion allowances, capital gain shelters, and special tax benefits for energy-producing industries. As he says, here is another case where the believers in the market pricing system ought to live by it. The public is subsidizing these industries twice, once by tax benefits, once by cost-free or below-cost disposal of waste and heat. And I think the time is here when we have to ask the user of energy, especially in this case electrical energy, to pay the entire cost instead of just a part of cost of producing energy. Well, let's talk about industry a bit. Now, production of goods basically requires capital, labor, and energy. Of course, it requires raw material too, but it requires capital, labor, and energy to change the raw material into some kind of desired goods and services. Since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, there's been a steady thrust to substitute energy for human labor. The reason for this is clear. Wages have increased dramatically, whereas energy costs have stayed more or less constant. The ratio of wages to electricity costs increased by 230% between 1950 and 1970 alone, according to a study made by the Energy Research Group at the University of Illinois. Only the rising cost of capital has prevented the shift has prevented a still greater shift to energy. You see, a shift from substitution of energy for labor also carries with it a certain amount of capital, because taking eliminating labor and going to energy requires fairly large machines and things that that require capital as well. And so capital has costs have increased, but energy costs have not. But wages have increased much more. From the workers' and consumers' point of view, of course, this substitution has been beneficial. It's meant less drudgery in the workplace, greater buying power, and more leisure, although it has led certainly to unemployment in certain sectors of the workforce. But all this has been based on dirt-cheap energy. To reverse this trend will require a substantial rise in energy cost, most probably through an energy tax. And those of you who have been following the series know that I favor strongly a tax on energy that will reflect more of the true cost to the consumer. For example, take the case of beverage containers. Requiring the use of refillable beverage containers, recyclable beverage containers now, changes or eliminates a considerable amount of energy and substitutes for it a considerable amount of labor. Somebody's got to go around and collect these bottles and cans, bring them back to the central place where they can be refilled, or in the case of cans, reprocessed. Now, furthermore, it changes the kind of labor, because it substitutes a rather high-cost factory, or for a rather high-cost factory labor, it substitutes a somewhat lower cost and a different style of labor in the person of the guy who goes around and collects them. Now, changes like this, of course, are going to be opposed very strongly by the people who make aluminum cans, because nobody wants their particular jobs eliminated, even though it means two jobs somewhere else in the sector. Transportation. Transportation accounts for 25%. Maybe I should stop at this point and ask if there are any comments on the on our my comments on the way we use energy in industry or in the home sector, home or commercial sector.
I just concur with you. The whole system is asinine. It works in circles. It defeats itself. And we pay for everything backwards. It's like you said, we pay for people to use more electricity, and then we say, don't use so much electricity, and then we give them subsidy. Same with the aluminum can industry. Tin is cheaper to make than aluminum, but the government subsidizes the aluminum, so they make aluminum. Mm-hmm.
Cheap electric power. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What are we going to do about it? You know, the of course, Oregon has taken the lead in this respect. And are any of you from Oregon? We had some people, we had a fellow from Portland here the other day. But primary purpose of the Oregon laws on recycling were to eliminate waste disposal. You know, clean up the highways, clean up and get away from empty cans and things, broken glass everywhere. But there have been so many spin-offs, in fact, things I think that people never really anticipated, that it's been one of those things that's been almost, from what I read at least, 100% good. In fact, they've gotten 101% of the benefit they anticipated. But yet, I don't know of any other state that's it's copied Oregon in this respect.
Like what sorts of spin-offs are there doing?
Well, just this thing we talk about, more jobs now. They've created jobs for people who have to collect these cans. And it's been good economically as well as just eliminating the cans along there.
Oh, another thing. When you're talking about heat pumps, you said you didn't know the whole model. My brother installs and maintains heat pumps for the home.
Now, where do you live?
South Dakota.
Yeah, I was going to say, I should qualify this. There are certainly medium climates, you know, farther south, in places where you're getting a little farther south, there are combination air conditioner heat pumps that I know of. Yeah, when I said heat pumps, I didn't know of anybody that made a full-scale system that was designed for use in a fairly cold climate, but apparently they do them. You said GE has one of them?
Yeah, sure, it's General Electric. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just a box outside of a big fan in the top. It switches either air conditioning.
Yeah, it's a little air conditioner.
Heat pump.
Very good.
Before they're pulling a lot of cold air.
What is a system like that for the cost for the average home? You know?
I'm not sure the cost. Mm-hmm. It's not much more than
just air conditioning. See, the problem is that even South Dakota, most parts of it, or you get up to Minnesota, or you get into the northern states, and heating load is much greater than the cooling load. You get down to about southern Illinois or central Missouri, somewhere in the 35 to 40 degree latitude, where the heating and cooling load are about balanced. And of course, there you can economically put in an air conditioning unit that can be used in reverse for heating. But you get up to Minnesota and you're going to have to put in a unit that's maybe three times as large as you need for air conditioning alone, so it starts to become costly. Of course, you get far south, and then the air conditioning load is greater than the heating load, so there's no problem. You can get the little amount of heating you need without any problem at all. But in the north country, you need a pretty large heat pump system. The interesting thing, of course, well, one interesting thing about industrial use of energy is that the amount of energy used per member of the workforce has not changed much, and that a great deal of the increase in the industrial use of energy in the industrial sector has been just tied to the increase in the working force. In fact, as I pointed out one of the earlier discussions, I was kind of amazed to realize that the amount of the increase in per capita energy use in this country from, let's say, in the last 200 years has been a fairly modest. It's nothing like a hundredfold or tenfold or even fourfold. It's more like twofold. We use approximately twice as much energy per person now as we did, say, 200 years ago. And most of this increase has come in the last 20 years. And most of it is tied to the increase in the working force. There's a much larger percentage of people employed now than there was 20 years ago. And, you think when the average family now, when back 20 years, Papa went to work and needed an office with light and heat, and Mama stayed home and needed a house with light and heat. Papa and Mama each go to work and need an office or a factory or whatever they do. They need something that with light and heat or energy, but the house still needs light and heat. And so that a lot of the increase in energy utilization is just directly tied to the percentage of people in the workforce.
In the same period, the what very interesting article was a reprint, it was in Reader's Digest. I couldn't remember what magazine was reprinted from, but it indicated that the middle income population during the same period that you're referring to had gone from something like 25% to 50% to 60%. And that the goods and services...
You mean of the energy use?
No, of just...
Oh, the middle class had increased.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That the goods and services purchased by the middle class, you know, represent 70-80% of all the televisions and all the... This is part of the same phenomenon.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a, you know, this is a hidden dilemma in this whole thing is, okay, you save energy some way, you use less energy. All right, unless the cost of the energy that you do use goes up drastically, why you also save money. But from an energy standpoint, this is bad because you're going to spend that money for something. And almost anything you spend it for, goods or services, requires energy. So unless you you save energy, but use the money you save to buy energy, less intensive goods and services, the net saving isn't there. In fact, it's funny. I think I've got a graph here that don't have any way of putting on the board, but I can sort of show it. That's it's rather surprising, or at least it was to me, and that is the way in which it's rather small, but you notice there are two curves. This is the energy impact in 10 to the 9th BTUs per year. And this is the income after taxes. All right, the lower curve, well, let me try to sketch it on the board. Here's energy, and here's income. Now, the amount spent for energy purchases, that is, for directly for gasoline, for electricity, and things that are directly related to energy, indeed does saturate. You get out here, you can only drive your car 24 hours a day. You can't do any more, you know. But the non-energy purchase continue to go up, and in fact, so that the total impact is very nearly linear. Which is rather surprising, and you know, the first thing you look at this and you say, well, good night. That curve proves that the only way you can really save energy is by reducing income. Now, to a first approximation, that is indicated, but there's more to it than that, and that is that this is kind of an average curve, and there's certainly a lot of things. There's a spread in goods and services, some that are more energy intensive and some of them are less energy intensive. And so even by spending the same amount of money on goods and services, you can in fact cut energy consumption by purchasing less intensive, energy intensive goods and services. But if kind of left to itself, why the energy consumption is going to tend to go up almost linearly with income.
Is there any study that's ever been made generally within the whole United States as to how much energy is actually wasted?
Well, I cited the figure in opening remarks that about 50% is wasted as waste heat. I mean, that is thermodynamically wasted. Now, I guess whether you know what you call wasting energy is a matter of definition, a matter of opinion. If you say driving your car to a neighboring city when you could have taken a bus, if you call that wasting energy, then of course the figure would be much higher. But 50% of it is actually wasted in as waste heat in conversion processes and as a result of poor heating and cooling practices and things of that nature. But in a broader sense, probably a much higher figure of that is at least if not wasted, could easily be eliminated without too much of a change in our standard of living. The part that we talked about. In fact, if we go back and look at our heat engine. Whoops, head instead of back. Well, this thing doesn't go back. anymore. I can't go back to that first one. There we go. All right. In thermodynamics now, we talk about an ideal heat engine. The efficiency of an ideal heat, the actual efficiency of a heat engine is the work you get out divided by the heat you put in. But the efficiency of an ideal heat engine would be T2 minus T1 over T2. That is this is what's known in engineering circles as a Carnot cycle. And so the ideal engine, if you built it absolutely as perfect as it could be, would be, you'd still have an efficiency that's limited by the temperature of the hot and cold reservoirs. Now, of course, any real heat engine is only going to approach the ideal, but the extent to which it approaches determines the efficiency of the engine. In the case of an internal combustion engine, the efficiency is largely governed by the compression ratio, because a higher compression engine burns the gasoline at a much higher temperature, and since your exhaust temperature is pretty well fixed, you've got limits on, unless you put on some kind of an elaborate water cooling system on your exhaust, you can't do much about that, and so the efficiency goes with compression. Well, as some of you know, I don't want to get into a lengthy discussion of automobile engine design, but as you know, when you increase the compression, you do several things that are not so desirable. You increase the efficiency, to be sure, and the gas mileage, but you make it necessary to burn a higher octane of gasoline, for one thing, to prevent pre-ignition or knock. And you also increase the rate at which noxious nitrous oxide compounds are created and put more of a pollution load on, well, nowadays on your catalytic converters. But you dump more nitrous oxide into the atmosphere. So there are trade-offs too. In the case of electrical power generation of a power plant, there's almost no disadvantage except just the problem with operating the thing of going to a higher temperature, and the efficiency goes up with increased temperature. In fact, that's one of the problems with the first generation nuclear reactors that we're using now. There are limitations on how high a temperature you can operate them, and therefore the efficiency is somewhat less than the best coal-fired steam generating plants, and therefore that leads to more waste heat. In fact, I think I've got a slide here that shows the waste heat per electrical unit of electricity generated of various types of converters, the present nuclear reactors, and that's not inherent in nuclear reactors at all, but just in the ones we're using now, the efficiency is fairly low. Steam turbines are somewhat higher with the magnetohydrodynamic converter that we talked about day before yesterday, I guess, being appreciably higher than the steam turbine. Well, let's talk about transportation. Transportation accounts for 25% of our total energy use, but more important than the 25% is that nearly all of our transportation systems require gasoline or refined fuel oil. And of course, that's the type of fuel now that is in very critical supply. And there's very little hope, at least right at this moment, of substituting any other kind of fuel. I don't think we're going to see coal burning Stanley steamers for a while. The automobile accounts for about 21% of the nation's energy if you count direct and indirect. That is, count not only the fuel, the gasoline that you use in the fuel tank, but consider the amount of energy that it took to make the automobile in the first place. And I put some statistics on the board that are surprising perhaps only in the amount of the disparity. I'm sure that you have been aware that the automobile and the airplane, our most popular forms of transportation, are also the least efficient ways of moving people. We put down here the BTUs per passenger mile, British thermal units of energy per passenger mile, for both urban and inner city use. And also in transporting freight, we've put down the number of BTUs per ton mile, that is, for carrying a ton of goods 1 mile, of pipeline, railroad, waterway, that is rivers, canals, things, trucks, and airplanes. In spite of this, during the 1960s, passenger traffic in the U.S. railroads decreased by half, automobile mileage increased by 50%, and airplane mileage increased threefold. Freight also showed a large shift from railroads to trucks and airplanes. A big factor certainly in this has been the government subsidy of automobiles, trucks, and airplane transportation through money put into roads and airports. Reversing this shift could certainly have a very result in a very significant saving of energy. Well,
why is there so much difference per passenger mile between buses and railroads? Looks like there's more difference between those two than between railroads and automobiles. Well,
for inner city use.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's see if we can think of a reason. This, of course, is not. This is actual usage, not potential usage, and part of that is certainly tied up in the load factor.
Mm-hmm.
If you could fill a train with people every time, you'd certainly reduce this figure greatly.
So with, like, European trains, it would be a lot less BTU per passenger.
If their load factors consistently run higher, it would be less. That's a good point.
Part of this is due to the fact that this is 1600, it must not be, but it's still a large, there's still a very, very large difference between the two, isn't it?
In fact, I think buses, let's talk about the medium haul problem. I've been a proponent of a freeway bus system. I just don't know why it hasn't been considered. Of course, I'd like to see the railroads restored to health, but that's going to require a massive capital expenditure, because right now the thing, I think, more than anything else that keeps people off the trains is the inconvenience of not knowing if the train is going to arrive hours late because railroad roadbeds are just in such terrible state of disrepair. And we have probably $1 billion worth of roadbed renewal to do with American railroads before there'll ever be any great shift back to railroads. And I think we should go full speed ahead on that, but at least there's a big problem. But I can't see any reason why a freeway bus system hasn't come into being. Now, I've taken several medium to long distance bus trips, but you get awfully annoyed because the buses waste a tremendous amount of time getting off the freeways into the cities, pulling up to the bus depot and stopping and saying, okay, now we're going to stop here 25 minutes for a rest stop. And even though there are bathrooms on the bus and so on and so forth. And so the overall time of getting from point A to point B, even with fast buses, is much larger than it needs to be. I think we should have hourly buses on all the major interstates, and the bus depot should be out there on the interstate system. You can, with parking lots, you can drive out there and get on the bus. It seems to me that if the density of people going from city A to city B is great enough to justify a $2 million a mile freeway, it's also great enough to justify hourly bus service. And these buses should serve meals like airplanes do, not necessarily complimentary meals, but there should be food available on board, food and drink, and all the amenities that travelers seem to like. Earphone, stereo, you know, and the like. And I think a system like that could take a tremendous load off the highways. If there were convenience and the speed of getting from one point to another were comparable to automobiles, why, it would save a lot on travel. There's no doubt about the fact that the American public is madly in love with their automobile. I don't know whether we'll ever succeed in divorcing them from this love affair or not, but we certainly can improve the efficiency of automobiles. The all automobiles, in my opinion, and certainly American cars, made ones, could get along with smaller power system. Now, of course, the question that's always raised is the safety factor. And everybody says, well, I've got to have 300 horsepower in my car because I might sometime want to pass a truck on a hill, and I've got to get by him fast, otherwise it isn't safe. Well, it's a point, of course. With a underpowered car, you have to change your driving habits a bit. But my pet idea along this line is a hybrid automobile, where one puts in a gasoline engine that's way undersized. It's just enough to keep the automobile running at a constant speed, and then puts in electric motors for acceleration and deceleration, and a small energy storage system. I don't think a fully electric car is a very desirable thing, except perhaps for getting to and from work, but until there's a dramatic breakthrough in battery technology and energy storage, I don't think we're going to see electric cars for general use at all. But a hybrid system is a totally different thing, because when you slow down, you make use of the mechanical energy of the car to charge the battery, and then you've got that surge of power, and DC motors are very, very high torque motors, and you've got that surge of power you can use if you feel you have to accelerate very rapidly to get around that big truck going uphill. And I'd like to see this come about. I'd like to see some consideration given to hybrid automobile systems like that. But we certainly can reduce the size of automobile engines, make them more efficient. Another thing that is popular in Europe, but there have been attempts to introduce it in this country, but I guess they failed economically, although I'm not sure that I fully trust the counting techniques of the American railroads, and that is car-carrying trains. No Frenchman ever thinks of driving from Paris to Nice. He puts his car on the, what is it they call it, the Blue something express. Drives his car on a flat car and gets a Pullman berth, and he's in the Riviera in the morning. Now, how many of you wouldn't have, if there had been a nice, you know, a train on the Burlington Northern or something from Chicago or Minneapolis out to Spokane, how many of you wouldn't have put your cars on it, had a nice relaxing ride, and then driven your car off at Spokane and driven the distance up to home? It's there are many places that it's not convenient to get to by train alone. And or if you're going someplace and are going to be in a city for several weeks or something like that, you like to have the convenience of a personal automobile, a rented automobile at the far terminal. It gets to be a rather expensive thing, but I think we should have cart-carrying trains going between major areas. Mass transit, of course, is another thing that a lot of study has been devoted to. Are any of you from the Bay Area? The prime example, of course, of a modern, recently engineered mass transit system is the Bay Area Rapid Transit. And as far as I can tell, it's been successful. BART certainly had its problems. There were several malfunctions and accidents in the first couple of years that it was in, the first few months it was in operation. But as far as I've been able to tell, it's the bugs are pretty well ironed out and everybody's reasonably happy with BART. Now, whether a transit system like that would be successful in other cities, you know, there's something unique about the Bay Area, but Washington, D.C. is putting in a similar type of computer-controlled, all-electric rapid transit system, which I guess will be completed in 2 or 3 years. But apart from that, there isn't an awful lot of planning for a new rapid transit on the horizon. Many cities have experimented with highly subsidized bus systems. I think Atlanta, isn't it 15 cents you can ride anywhere in the city or something like that. The results are not always positive. Sometimes they find that regardless of how much the fare is reduced, it doesn't get an awful lot of cars off the road. Sometimes it does. But certainly a tremendous amount of thought has to go in to this problem of moving people within cities. There's been talk now in Chicago about banning cars in the loop completely, and I wouldn't be surprised to see this come within the next 2 or 3 or 5 years. It's just if automobiles are inefficient out on the highway, in the city they're just almost in a large city, they're almost unthinkable as an efficient means of moving people in and out of the city. Now, of course, one of the major problems with mass transit is the transit patterns that people have. A few years back, when mass transit was more popular, most of the commutation tended to be in and out of the city. But now, in most metropolitan areas, that accounts for only a small percentage of the total commutation. And it's very difficult to design a mass transit system that will take care of all this cross-commutation. But it's a case of the chicken and the egg. These cross-commutation paths and things and living patterns have grown up because of the automobile, and now they kind of lock us into the system. And there isn't an easy answer to the urban transportation problem. I think in many ways the inner city problem is perhaps easier to solve than the inner city one. Well, let's see, I guess I've got a few again, facts and figures on cars. This is the miles per gallon of all U.S. cars. Of course, I'm sure it's no news to you that that's been steadily declining. Even in spite of technology, steadily goes down. This is the number of motor vehicles in millions, and that steadily goes up. And the two curves sort of put us on a crash course. This gives the breakdown of power utilization in the automobile at highway speeds now. The rolling friction accounts for about a quarter of the energy. Aerodynamic drag accounts for about a quarter of the energy that's used. And the in order to get more efficient operation, you'd like to reduce both of these. Well, the one small technological improvement of just of introduction of radial tires, as you know, had a very dramatic effect on rolling friction. There's been little done to improve aerodynamic losses in automobiles. Styling still rules. You know, ever since the Chrysler disaster of the 1940s, why manufacturers have been very, very hesitant to try to get away from the chrome and you know, and pizzazz design of their automobiles. As you know, Chrysler did a very careful survey. They thought, they went around and asked many, many people what it was they wanted an automobile. And they said, okay, we're going to design the automobile like the consumer wants. Well, everybody said, oh, we want one that's dependable, rather plain, lots of headroom, lots of legroom, rather boxy, and all this sort of stuff. So Chrysler built a car like that and almost went bankrupt because what the public said they wanted and what the public bought in the showroom were two completely different things. So Chrysler did a complete about face and put massive fins on the cars in the early 1950s, and lots of chrome, lots of pizzazz, and their sales just soared again. American consumer is sometimes hard to predict. We're kind of a fickle lot. What we say we want and what we buy often aren't one and the same thing, especially in automobiles. Well, let's have some discussion on chapter two here, the conservation as applied to transportation.
You know, I've had a thought in my mind for a couple of years ever since this crisis, so-called crisis, came along. And it has to do with a style of car to be a one-passenger vehicle for most people have a second car, and mm-hmm. one member of the family uses that second car to go almost strictly back and forth to work. Mm-hmm. And I really see no reason why you couldn't have basically a one-passenger, lightweight, small car that would get tremendous gas mileage and take up much less room, parking, driving, everything. And they could basically build it so that it would be crash-worthy also. Mm-hmm. And instead of spending so many billions of dollars trying to solve a system or a problem with mass transit and so on, which I personally don't think is ever going to work in this country because of the habits of people and the living patterns of people. I don't think you're going to move people from where they are to a high rise or whatever so you can keep them all closed up. It seems to me that we would be much better to try to attack the problem from using an efficient system that was designed for people the way they operate today.
Because the small car it takes care of one of the problems, namely fuel consumption. It reduces that greatly, but it doesn't take care of the other problem, namely the congestion, the enormous need for roads, the energy that it takes, that goes into highway building and bridge building and road building, and really that doesn't get much better. A small car takes up almost as much space, freeway space, as a large car.
But isn't it true that they basically built the freeways and all the roads? They don't build them for cars. They build them for trucks. You don't need 12, 14 inches of concrete to run a 4,000-pound car on. You know, I think that the public has been sold a bill of goods. This expense that they talk about, and they try to blame it on people and passenger cars, and that's a bunch of baloney. And same, all of bridges. Those bridges are built for tanks and trucks. They're not built for cars.
Would you put on a dual highway system with some roads just for cars?
No, but I think just for trucks or what? No, I don't believe that either. But I think that the public should be aware of what the problem is. And I see trucks coming around with signs about how much taxes they pay on the back of them, you know, and that's, if you ask me, they ought to be paying about 100 times more than that to pay their fair share.
Oh, I agree.
We've been ripped off on the interstate system and it's too late. I heard an interesting theory about setting up a intercity rail transport system down the lane between the interstates.
Yeah.
And they had the bed was already there and everything else up on stilts above them.
That happens in Chicago, well, something like that in Chicago.
Yeah.
They have mass transportation trains which run between the lanes on Interstates 90 and 94.
Yeah, right.
The amount of farmland that they have sucked up in those interstates is just from...
Well, I argued at the time the interstates were being built, there should be provision in the country, you know, in all the country. The provision would be mainly leaving enough space with the bridge, designing the overpasses and things, so there could be mass transit down the center.
We have a peculiar society where 100 years ago we were subsidizing the railroads.
Yeah.
And the last 2-3 decades we've subsidized the highway system to kill the railroads.
Right.
They're always out there. Years ago they had Isle Acres farm program where they pay you not to farm one kind of land and then they pay you to take a pond or a marsh and drain it so you have more farmland. Both programs are absolutely opposite. But your question about a small car, Mother Earth News, this magazine about alternative lifestyles and getting back to land, so they have developed a prototype suburban car that seats two, gets 60 miles per gallon, and I guess they're starting to market it. You can get it in gas, burning, electric, and one other source. I'm not sure what the current source is.
You agree, Tom, that as long as we can afford the automobile, and as long as it's still the most convenient method of getting from one point to another, the other systems that would improve efficiency, such as mass transit systems, are going to have a terrific struggle. In fact, almost impossible to really develop them.
Well,
as long as you have that choice.
I guess that's my pessimistic, most pessimistic boundary. You know, I kind of vacillate. I guess I'm not sure. At sometimes I say that all we need to do is really inform people, preach, you know, and get, and that there is a chance of some public spirit here. That we won't necessarily continue reckless consumption of energy till the last drop is gone. I still think that if we really put on a full-scale educational or jawboning campaign, it may produce some results. Although I'll have to say, and this is a little bit of cynicism, I guess I feel I've gotten a little bit discouraged just by this week here. I really thought there would be more, there would be more interest in discussion of this topic than I've gotten. So if a presumably informed, concerned community like we have at home has little interest in the problem, perhaps I'm overly optimistic when I say that we can persuade the American public that something has to be done.